My name is Michael Pellet, and I teach theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And this week, the sessions that I will be leading are centered around the notion of koinonia. And koinonia, listed here, literally can be translated as something like community or participation. And it's one of the key phrases which the New Testament uses in understanding what it means to be the church. And my contention this week is that, at least within our contemporary understanding of church and within our contemporary Christianity and theologies, we have forgotten much about this understanding of koinonia. And so I'm hoping this week that we can retrieve some of these senses of the koinonia connection and enable that to once again be part of our theology for the contemporary church. Yesterday in the session, as I outlined some of the notions of koinonia, I characterized koinonia as comprising or being constituted by three dimensions that I call the three C's: community, compassion, and combat. And we talked about that a little bit yesterday and what that might entail for our understanding of what it means to be church. Today, what I want to look at is precisely why the notion of koinonia has collapsed within our contemporary understanding of the church. And my claim is that the reason koinonia has collapsed is that it has been supplanted by another concept which has values of its own, which I've called ecclesial Darwinism. And again, ekklesia, another Greek word or term meaning church or the called out ones. And the reason I use ecclesial rather than church or so is to get away again from the notion of a building or an institution, but to think much more again of the concepts and values which have been integrated in what it means to be church. And today I want to claim that the church has assimilated values particularly associated with social Darwinism into its understanding of evangelism and church growth and what constitutes a successful, healthy, dynamic congregation. And so I want to trace here in the first half of our time together, kind of trace why the church fell into, if you will, this trap of ecclesial Darwinism, and some of the values that I think from the New Testament may counter those values, and then hopefully we can open it up for discussion and again see from your experiences and your understandings of church where you think we're at in all of this. To begin to talk about ecclesial Darwinism and so on and so forth, we need to back up to the turn of the century, between 1880 and following, with the rise of social Darwinism. And so that's where I'm going to begin, and I'm going to begin with a quote from Cecil Rhodes. He says, quote, "I contend that we are the first race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race. If there be a God, I think that what he would like me to do is to paint as much of the map of Africa British red as possible." Unquote. These are the words of British imperialist and industrialist Cecil Rhodes as he thundered his way across southern Africa. Meanwhile, back on the serene east coast of the United States, the best-selling book of 1885 was entitled Our Country, Its Possible Future and Our Present Crisis, and it was written by the Reverend Josiah Strong. In it, he states, quote, "Whether the extinction of inferior races before the advancing Anglo-Saxon seems to the reader sad or otherwise, it certainly appears probable. Look at the Dutch Boers successfully making their way in South Africa, or at the English as they moved into Africa and India. Their advance might be God's final and complete solution to the dark problem of heathenism among many inferior peoples." Unquote. These two quotations reflect the vogue of social Darwinism of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Social Darwinism, promulgated more by Herbert Spencer and Alfred Russel Wallace than by Charles Darwin, and seized upon by European and North American political leaders and industrialists, from Cecil Rhodes and Prime Minister William Gladstone to John D. Rockefeller and Elihu Root, Teddy Roosevelt's Secretary of State, all provided a persuasive rationalization for expansion with its doctrines of struggle for existence and survival of the fittest. With these doctrines in hand, the Western world assumed the innate superiority of their civilization, of their race, and of their religion. Alfred Russel Wallace writes, quote, "The great law of the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life leads to the inevitable extinction of all those low and mentally undeveloped populations with which Europeans come in contact. The intellectual and moral, as well as the physical qualities of the European are superior. The same power and capacities which have made him rise in a few centuries from the condition of the wandering savage with a scanty and stationary population to his present state of culture and advancement with a greater average longevity, a greater average strength, and a capacity of more rapid increase, enable him, when in contact with the savage man, to conquer in the struggle for existence and to increase at his expense, just as the more favorable increase at the expense of the less favorable varieties in the animal and vegetable kingdoms, just as the weeds of Europe overrun North America and Australia, extinguishing more native productions by the inherent vigor of their organization and by their greater capacity for existence and multiplication." Unquote. Needless to say, today many peoples and nations of the two-thirds world point out the dehumanizing, oppressive, and exploitative consequences of this position. We in the West are trying to be as sensitive as possible to the conditions created by this view. Certainly, the Church recognizes how many of its earlier mission strategies and tactics were based on this rationale and is in the process of correcting it. James Shearer, in his book, Gospel, Church, and Kingdom, details the changes in missiology from the late 19th century to the present day. But there is another consequence of social Darwinism that is not so apparent because it is not so external. It is the aspect that entails not what we have done to others, but what we have done and are doing to ourselves. It is the aspect of having internalized the mechanisms of social Darwinism and appropriate them as the values of progress and individualism. Herein lies the problem. The understanding of progress that social Darwinism appropriated from Darwin was based on a biological model. Human progress resulted from a competitive struggle in which superior individuals and races triumphed over inferior ones. Thus, one's capacity to survive also measured one's moral, intellectual, and spiritual superiority. The contradiction is that the biological criterion of survival provides no real measure for human progress. Survival is a precondition of progress, but it does not ensure progress or define progress. In the last analysis, natural selection does not necessarily mean the survival of the fittest, but it's a logical tautology and therefore simply means the survival of those who survived. Survival was a brute fact, not a moral, intellectual, or spiritual victory. Yet the effects remain. In the world, and we know it's a jungle out there, the law of the jungle still dominates. Competition, consumption, success, growth are still evaluated in terms of the biological criterion of survival. This is no less the case in the church, where we are confronted with the phenomenon of ecclesial Darwinism. The best churches are those which have best exhibited the biological capacity to survive, those that remain numerically and financially viable the longest. Again, to quote Wallace, here are the three criteria on the board: a greater average longevity, a greater average strength, and a capacity for more rapid increase. Those were the three criteria Wallace said enabled Europeans, both weeds and people, to overrun the world. Is this our criteria for church growth as well? With the decline in church growth, the church has jumped to the unwarranted conclusion that we face a crisis regarding our survival. I can only claim that this is unwarranted if I refuse to operate under the criteria of ecclesial Darwinism. Is the mission of the church, the structure of the church, or the vitality of the church to be measured by the biological criteria of greater average longevity, a greater average strength, and a capacity for more rapid increase? How do these criteria fit with Jesus' criterion for the church and for discipleship? Whoever would save one's life will lose it, and whoever loses one's life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Biologically, this is not a very vital passage. It spells extinction, not survival. In terms of the church, however, it is constitutive of the very life and function of the church itself. Yet ask yourself, who or what does your particular congregation represent in your local area and community? Does your congregation represent itself, its needs, its desires, its rights? Or does it represent the neighbor, the one who is in need of our help, and to whom we are to be little Christs? Douglas John Hall claims that the church operates carefully and predictably within a certain set of rules. And I've summarized these three rules here as ABC. The first rule: the church can support movements and causes that are clearly within the realm of conventional Christianity. The second rule: the church can support other groups so long as its identification with them does not compromise the church. That is, so long as fraternization with such groups does not get the church into trouble with its primary sponsor, the dominant culture. Rule number three: the church will take part in activities involving other groups, provided it can maintain a clear organizational autonomy, and still more desirable, a clear-cut authority.
Mike, in these statements, when you're talking about the church, do you mean the church as congregation or the church as organization or both?
Both. Yeah. It's still, again, a more general characterization in terms of, if you will, charting church behavior and how they want to act, and in terms of, again, remain conventional, don't cross your key supporter, namely the dominant culture, and three, maintain your autonomy and clear-cut authority at all times. Right, three key rules to guarantee survival.
Tell us a little bit about the distinction between B and C. You don't want to cross the dominant culture, but yet you want to maintain your autonomy and authority.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that not wanting to cross the dominant culture is that kind of notion of civil religion, or anything that happens, if you will, since post-Constantinian Christianity, where you look upon the culture and the values of the culture as something that you support, and indeed as the church, that's what you want to legitimize and make plausible. On the other hand, the autonomy and clear-cut authority comes in terms of, you want to make sure that while you support the values of the culture, you are also able to find your own particular niche in the culture, where you have your clear place so that you can justify your reason for being. So in other words, you want to do things like, before you have a war with Iraq, make sure you have somebody come into the White House and pray.
But that's different than claiming all authority over all things.
Yes, right. That's very different. I mean, it's a clear-cut authority. You have your place. It's not claiming authority over all things. And we'll see that by designating that, as we look at some sociologists, namely Robert Bella and Reginald Bibby, they'll note that by just noting particular places, we see how that's changed then the church into just another buffet where people can pick and choose the goodies they like. Okay. While all our good rhetoric about mission and ministry is designed to ensure the better functioning of the priesthood of all believers in their vocation and in their calling, in their mission to and for the world, the rules and structures of ecclesial Darwinism are so deeply entrenched within the body of Christ that ministry is almost always appropriated and enacted as a way of designating the authority and survival of the church in the world. Again, to quote Hall, he says, "It is not the business of the church to turn the world into the church. It is the church's business, rather, to point to the presence in and throughout the world of the King who is turning the world into his kingdom." Unquote. But the problems for the church are not over. They are just beginning. Because social Darwinism is not simply lurking in the pews and vestries of our churches. It has manifested itself in illustrious garb in our secular society under the name of individualism. Sociologist Robert Bella and associates, in the book Habits of the Heart, chart the role this individualism plays in North American middle-class society, and more alarmingly, the values, namely of survival, that go with it. One of his personality types is called Margaret. And Margaret expresses this individualist, self-reliant ethic, a grim and lonely ethic of survival in this way. Quote, "I just sort of accept the way the world is and then don't think about it a whole lot. I tend to operate on the assumption that what I want to do and what I feel like is what I should do. What I think the universe wants from me is to take my values, whatever they might happen to be, and live up to them as much as I can. If I'm the best person I know how to be according to my lights, then something good will happen. I think in a lot of ways, living that kind of life is its own reward in and of itself. Unquote. And here, this last sentence, living that kind of life is its own reward. Think about that over against the text we had this morning in the Bible study with Doug, Matthew 6, verses 1 through 4, part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where again he talks about piety and almsgiving and what reward is all about. And here again, I think you can begin to see the distinctions of the way Margaret understands and talks about reward and the kind of reward that Jesus is talking about in Matthew chapter 6. Another one of Bella's characterizations, Brian. Brian states, what happens when this self-reliant ethic of survival confronts a notion of God? Quote, I want to be in control of things, and I figure God put me on earth to take care of myself and not to do his work for him. I'll leave the big problems for him to solve. Little ones, I'll solve for him. Unquote. Now even God is dependent upon the criterion of survival. If God is not fit enough to persist in the struggle for life, well, that's God's problem. If God can't cope, why should God exist? Against this backdrop of individualism, Bella highlights this somber and sober conclusion about the church. Quote, the quasi-therapeutic blandness that has afflicted much of mainline Protestant religion at the parish level for over a century cannot effectively withstand the competition. And note that. Can't withstand the competition of the more vigorous forms of radical religious individualism with their dramatic claims of self-realization. Unquote. Concomitant with this stress on individualism and competition is the loss of the sense of community, participation, commitment to what is common. Koinonia is the New Testament term. With the internalization of social Darwinism and the manifestation of individualism also comes the collapse of koinonia. This is where you should wear your hard hats. Quote, again from Bella, the notion that one discovers one's deepest beliefs in and through tradition and community is not very congenial to Americans. Most of us imagine an autonomous self existing independently, entirely outside any tradition and community, and then perhaps choosing one. Unquote. Although we may no longer look to the koinonia of the church as our mother, we still have our heroes in our contemporary culture. The cowboy and the detective become the role models for the individual in society. The Lone Ranger, the rugged John Wayne character who exhibits true grit, the hard-bitten and experienced battered Bogart character, who whether found in Casablanca or piloting the African Queen or chasing down the Maltese Falcon, is a completely autonomous individual who stands outside society. Bella says, to serve society, one must be able to stand alone, not need others, not depending on their judgment, and not submitting to their wishes, unquote. And how many times, here's a little secret now, when pastors talk about pastors, do we talk about those quote-unquote lone rangers out there in the parish? Indeed, within the structure of ecclesial Darwinism, isn't the expectation of what a pastor is someone who is a self-reliant, self-sufficient individualist who can stand alone without the need of help from others and yet assure the survival of the church? With the aid of trustworthy tanto, that's the non-ordained role of the spouse, Kemosabe and the faithful companion are engaged in a never-ending battle of worship and altar guild, confirmation and Sunday school, counseling and choir, and a host of other programs to keep the church alive. And when the time comes and our lone ranger accepts another call, someone in the congregation will ask, "Who was that Al Christian? I didn't have a chance to ask about an evangelism." While a facetious scenario, I don't think it rings untrue. Reginald Bibby, in assessing the status of religion in contemporary Canada in his book Fragmented Gods, reluctantly concludes, quote, "It's hard to say it, but nonetheless it needs to be said. Canada's religious groups are largely responsible for the country's drop-off in attendance. The main reason is that the groups have responded to social and cultural change by offering religion as a range of consumer goods. Rather than saying to culture, this is what religion is, they have been much more inclined to say to culture, what do you want religion to be? Rather than presenting religion as a system of meaning that insists on informing all of one's life, the groups have broken it down and offered it as a wide variety of belief, practice, program, and service items," unquote. Within the context of ecclesial Darwinism, this loss of attendance is devastating. It threatens the congregation's value of survival, and for the pastor, it means burnout. For as Bibby tells us, quote, "It's not an easy thing to maintain a positive clerical self-image in the face of an ever-dwindling congregation," unquote. And as we all know, the Lone Ranger never lost. Moreover, evangelism to bolster members may not be a viable cure for a congregation experiencing the crisis of survival. Bibby's statistics indicate that Canadians, and he's also done a study that sees that this is the same for people within the United States, seldom move away from the religious preferences of their parents. There is a high level of what he calls, quote-unquote, affiliational stability, and people cannot be expected nor do they move in random fashion from one group to another. Why aren't the churches full then? Individualism leads to specialization and a consumption-oriented society. Religion, too, then, becomes a commodity characterized in terms of consumption rather than in terms of commitment. People readily adapt religious fragments, isolated beliefs, isolated practices, and isolated professional services. But they make no pretense that religion informs the totality of their lives. Nor is the problem confined to urban areas. Bibby's statistics indicate that, quote, The differences in commitment many people expect to find between big city and farm simply do not exist. People in North America living in communities large and small show remarkably similar tendencies." Unquote. Bibby maintains the conflict many people have with religious commitment, explains that conflict in this way, quote, "Many frustrated people have, somewhat defensively, protested that religion is simply not relevant to life as they know it. A simple way of saying that fragments do. Religious organizations have been responding to such a religious consumption style with remarkable efficiency. Ironically, they themselves have made it possible for people to move with relative ease from religious commitment to religious consumption. Again, ecclesial Darwinism has led to the collapse of koinonia. In order to survive, the church has communicated to its people that one can pick and choose those items of Christianity which comfortably fit with the way one wants to live one's life without any conflict. Thus, the times of particular significance within the life of an individual are also the times when one is interested in the goods and services which the church has to offer. Baptisms, confirmations, weddings, and funerals are the blue chip stocks on the Canadian, Western European, and United States ecclesiastical commodities exchange. Koinonia is gone. Participation is replaced by attendance at occasional services. Bibby concludes, quote, "When religion is drawn upon in accordance with the whims of customers, the gods are dismantled. They are custom made according to individual taste. Rather than looking to them for direction, we direct them, as if we were ventriloquists and they our dummies. When religion becomes nothing more than a consumer item, then the customer is in charge. The gods, relegated to an a la carte role, have little to say about everyday life. In North America, the stability of religious affiliation is matched by the poverty of religious significance." Unquote. An addendum at this point is in order regarding an implication for the seminary education of pastors. In other words, I'm going to engage in a little self-criticism here. We live a bureaucratic individualism. This is again a term by Robert Bellah. And what he means by bureaucratic individualism is that we insist on finding our true selves independent of any social or cultural influences. And yet, ironically, we manipulate and are manipulated by government agencies, corporations, and all sorts of bureaucratic structures. The best expression of this quote-unquote bureaucratic individualism is the manager and the therapist. Reginald Bibby notes that normally priests, ministers, and rabbis, quote, "are not necessarily good personnel coordinators or business managers. Even though clergy consistently report that most of their time is taken up with administrative matters, seminary training seldom gives extensive attention to teaching these skills. As a consequence, many trained clergy are faced with the difficulty of being prepared best for what they do least and prepared worst for what they do most." Unquote. Bibby then charts how churches that are quote unquote successful have as a strong component in their success quotient pastors who are managers and provide therapeutic counseling to people in their flock. Thus, the pastor becomes truly Christ-like by incarnating two natures, manager and therapist, in one person. Ironically, this is the example par excellence of the bureaucratic individualist. Another manifestation of ecclesial Darwinism and the preservation of the church in its struggle for life. Into this poverty of religious significance, as Bibby called it, how do we as the ecclesia, the church, the called out ones, the people of God, infuse and evoke within us the appropriation of the abundant life, the koinonia given to us by Christ? And more importantly, how do we practice that abundant life, koinonia, with those around us in our communities? That's the open question. That's where I would propose where we can see in contrast to longevity and strength and increase, we need to think about ourselves and church and koinonia as incarnational and reconciling and in an eschatological kind of way. And I will be more than happy to talk about that in a moment. But let me stop right now, because I've been doing a lot of talking at you, and open it up for your comments and reactions in terms of, as you think about your own congregations and your own situation, do you see some of these characteristics of ecclesial Darwinism and these senses of survival or lone ranger mentalities and what that entails, and that notion of pastor as manager and so on and so forth? Or is this not at all something that falls into line with the experiences you've had at church?
One comment, the Lutheran commentator, which is a political bi-monthly magazine or journal that comes out, and the latest one, some of you may have noted, has called for the resignation of Herbert Chilstrom from the ELCA, and they give, I believe it's 4 points, and basically all four are the very thing that you've just stated, for the reason he needs to get out. He's done everything along that line. He's bought into that whole notion. He's played the Lone Ranger role. They pick up on that. It's an interesting comment, or 2 pages, if anyone's interested, I'll certainly share it. But they've picked up on that notion that is part of what is ailing this new church in the ELCA for us, is that we're totally immersed in that, and we can't see any way to get out of it. So, if anyone's interested.
The thing that I found myself getting confused about was, I'm trying to figure out if this is supposedly a fairly recent drift of the church. When we think of the collapse of koinonia, is koinonia something that did actually exist within the church in fairly recent history and is now being seen to collapse, or should I not be able to remember it myself?
Given that I know your age, you should not be able to remember it yourself as though it happened just in your lifetime. Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is a process that's been going on, quite frankly, for the last 100 years.
Because I would certainly say that in my own memory, a certain kind of commitment was certainly a stronger element in an earlier generation than, say, in my generation. This whole smorgasbord approach, or, you know, sampling around for whatever it is that you want, I think has become much more prevalent in recent years than it might have been at one time.
I think here again, it's hit different, if you will, it's hit different denominations at different times. In some senses, I think we as Lutherans have been lucky or not so lucky, depending on your assessment of that, in that it's hit us much later than many others, because as immigrants to North America and so on and so forth, we were latecomers, and we did a very good job of maintaining our ethnic identities. And so therefore, often the church was that place where we did maintain our ethnic identities, and so we were committed to church, maybe not because we thought church was so great, but I mean, we just couldn't let the lutefisk suppers go and the sauerkraut suppers and all of those, so we kept the Scandinavian and the German heritage alive. But now, as we're third, fourth, fifth generation over here, you know, that whole sense is being scattered and diversified, and so we are now much more part of the culture. Please go on.
Well, in our church, in Irvine, California, I think would be much an example of that. We did a ministry study in which we looked at what our church was actually doing, and we defined ministry in terms of what the gospel would expect of us, and we couldn't identify. This is in a growing church from about 100 to about 400 or so participating members per Sunday. We couldn't identify a ministry that our church was doing in any way, and yet it was a friendly church. It was a growing church, and as we looked at it, those are exactly the kinds of things that we were seeing that we were doing. We clearly were in the dominant culture. We're conventional things, which were primarily family-oriented, and we did very little to rock the boat. But I think that can be turned around, and I'd be very interested to hear what you say about how that's done. For example, small groups, caring ministries, changing to a ministry orientation as opposed to these other things, more of a spiritual base to what we're doing. Is that the kind of stuff that you see as a resolution to that conflict? Because what we've seen is that the community now is both turning in on itself and back out into the community. It's forming groups for codependence, for example, which is mushrooming. We're forming groups, men's groups and different specialty groups, which also are mushrooming, and therefore meeting the needs of the people within that congregation. And as they're coming to the congregation and joining those groups, we're seeing that they're growing spiritually. And as they do that, they want to reach out into the community and form a ministry of some sort. We're sort of at the growing part of that. That's been a process since we identified that as a problem about a year and a half ago. But we've seen that the church itself, and as well as the pastor, has changed that approach. And I wonder if that's not a process throughout the church.
I wondered when you were saying that before whether you felt that part of the reason for the lateness of this coming to the Lutheran Church was the fact that the Lutheran Church had been predominantly rural for so long, or at least it's my impression as somebody who came to the Lutheran Church very late in life. And, you know, small communities and rural communities might have been more conducive to community forming anyway. They were basically, by their very structure, community. Some work I did a few years ago on urban revivals in the United States in this latter half of the 19th century, to me, were the most enlightening things of discovering the process by which Christianity got retranslated into American civic religion and the type of individualism that you're describing. And those were essentially a product of urban social patterns of the second half of the 19th century. But they have managed to retranslate Christian terminology and equate Christian concepts with what constitutes individualism in American civic religion.
Just one response to that. I don't know if it's been only that Lutheranism has been primarily rural. I mean, on the East Coast, Lutheranism is more urban. But even within in the rural communities, I think this survival mentality has existed. To think of this somewhat bizarre behavior in the small rural community, which is, you know, four blocks square, and on one end of town you have the Lutheran church, and on the other end of town you have the Methodist church, right? And there are very clear-cut distinctions between that, you know, and on Sunday, there is this tremendous separation. Any other time during the week, you know, you go down to the farm elevator or in the store and all the Lutherans and Methodists are friends, but boy, when it comes to church on Sunday, there's this real survival mentality, and, you know, somehow the notion is we've got to go out there and convert, you know, the Methodists got to convert the Lutherans and the Lutherans got to convert the Methodists. I think that's, again, showing the way in which this is kind of sunk into our psyche. I thought I saw a hand or a comment. Yes.
I'm interested in your comment about the Lone Ranger mentality, especially as far as pastors and other church leaders are concerned, because it seems to me that the people who've been influential in my life over the years have been just such people who were characters, but they were Christian characters. I think even the establishment of this place, and initially at least, people like Carol Hindley, who was the first director, he was a real Lone Ranger. But he had an influence far beyond his number. And I think of Luther himself, who was also called a wild boar on a number of occasions. That's a sort of a... it seems to me that what we need is more Lone Rangers, but of a Christian commitment to ministry type, rather than the pallid institutional form which we so often get. I'd be interested in your comment about that. Perhaps I've misunderstood what you're saying, but it seems to me that I just think of ministry back home in Sydney, for example, in Australia, and the pastors who are successful in that, it's an environment that is antagonistic, but much more indifferent to what Christianity has to present, let alone Lutheranism. But the pastors who have been successful there have been more the Lone Ranger type, but more of people who are interested in ministry and of Christian service.
When you say that they have been successful, what do you count as the criteria for success?
In influencing people and bringing them to Christ. I'm not talking about congregational membership necessarily, or numbers.
Further to that, I would add, I don't know what book we were reading in, but you can be too much of a Lone Ranger, The Catholicism of the young Turk who sees a vision and wants to do something different doesn't survive ultimately, because your institutional standard and your other Lone Rangers will then herd together and somehow get rid of this one who is too perhaps threatening or goes at it a different way and doesn't take the institutional norm. They can't understand that nor handle it quite often. And even though these very Lone Rangers or very wild Turks, whatever they are speaking to people where they are at, more than the institutional church, they're not allowed quite often to continue a ministry like that. So that's sort of the other side.
What's your comment to that? I'd be interested to hear you. There's a comment.
Well, I was a comment to that. One is again, I find it very interesting that in talking about the pastors in that way, also how you have, or in so doing, it ties in the whole notion of ministry back to the pastor. Like, you know, it is that pastor who does the ministry in that congregation, in that church, in that place, right? He, she is the one who is influencing people, has the impact on their lives, so on and so forth. Again, it's not the sense of the people of God at that place engaged in ministry, right? We have this individual who's going out there doing it alone. Good, you know, I think that again just simply shows the kind of values we have. Secondly, about this kind of understanding and the Lone Ranger. It's very interesting, and again, here I look at this from my position as a seminary prof, so I don't always have to engage in the competition, but pastoral conferences are wonderful things sometimes to be a speaker at, or a clergy cluster, where supposedly, right, all the ordained are getting together, and the pastors, you know, now here's a chance, right? It's pastors there, all the laity are gone, so now we can quote unquote be ourselves and open up and tell one another what's really bothering us and our hurts and our pains and where we're weak and we need help. Huh. If there's any place of, you know, one-upmanship and I'm better than you are and I'm, you know, well, we just had an evangelism program and we, you know, and the kind of competition, right? I mean, in terms of mutual conversation and consolation, you're not going to find it at most pastoral and clergy clusters. Why? Because, I mean, they're all trying to sell you and convince one another that they're in a happy, helpful, dynamic, and growing congregation. Or if they're not, it's a place that was sick before they ever took the call there, and they knew it, and this is what they're doing. But it's, you know, at that point, and again, the kind of interesting maybe perspective I have at a place like that is because I can't count the number of times that this has happened, right? You can hear this person, you know, given things are going great, you know, to three or four other clergy folk. And then, you know, later on, kind of in a corner over a cup of coffee, they'll come up to me because I'm not in a parish and therefore they don't have to compare it with that. And, you know, they just say, life is hell. I'm burnt out. I'm falling apart. I gotta get out of here. But, you know, why can't you go to your brothers and sisters in the ministry for help and support? I mean, I would think we're in this together, but no, I mean, because there again, all of this sense of longevity and strength and rapid increase is so important. We've wrapped our identity around these kinds of values that we can't even level with one another. I mean, and I know there are some other pastors here. I mean, if you think I'm all wet, say so. But
I relate exactly to what you're saying, but I would also say that there are a few of the different and of the Lone Ranger type that I'm thinking about who wouldn't even come to a conference like that because they reckon it's a waste of time.
And you know, thinking of the examples that you've used, Carl, I mean, I think you have a different concept of Lone Ranger than what Mike is presenting. I mean,
That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I think what Mike is talking about is a very isolated person who is afraid to ever reveal themselves. The kind of leaders that you just described were certainly strong leaders, I mean, there's no doubt about that, and able to operate independently, but totally revealing themselves. I mean, part of the reason they got into trouble is they were revealing everything all the time. And we're not concerned about longevity or strength or rapid increase. They were always talking about how this whole place might fall apart tomorrow. And that's why they were able to take all kinds of wild risks and try all kinds of crazy things. But that's very different than the masked person who will not reveal himself and just drops in and leaves town immediately and won't be engaged in the community.
Please.
What I was going to say is something drawing on sort of adding what Nancy was saying. I was going to ask the question, is there a distinction between lone rangers and prophets? And hear, and I agree exactly what you're saying about Lone Rangers. The question I would have then, if we've gotten ourselves into this fix, if we have adopted the dominant culture, then we need people who are going to be prophets and who are not, who are going to speak out of that context. And what is the difference between, and that's often a very fine distinction, I think. Well, very often, I think prophets get branded as Lone Rangers, and unfortunately, some Lone Rangers become, in my opinion, considered to be false prophets, or become prophets when I think they might be false prophets. But that would seem to me one way of framing the question. And how does a pastor or another leader within the church come without being a Lone Ranger to a point of trying to influence the church into taking another direction? And can that be done in a way? I mean, one of the often criteria about community organizing is, which I did in the past, is that if you're really a good community organizer, when a project's done, like a low-income housing project, that you can't identify the community organizer. You know, are there ways for pastors or other church leaders to be involved in that way? And when do we need people who are going to be very much out on the cutting edge and out in the front lines and be recognizable? And I think both are necessary.
I was just going to say that I are one, and in our pastoral groups, I've often come walked away from some feeling that, and I don't use the word Lone Rangers, but prima donnas. And that's a very judgmental term, but I use it as one way. I mean, you know, I'm in that group myself. But I think the most helpful gatherings of pastors I've been in, and fortunately, I feel I've been in one now for a number of years, is where we can come and, in a sense, let our hair down in the sense of this is hurting, this is painful, you know, and that type of mutual support without having to play the game. Now, the other thing is, I'm wondering if it's territorial. I grew up in southern Minnesota. My first parish was in southern North Dakota, then northern North Dakota, now northern Idaho. And I have seen, I go back to the Midwest now and I can hardly stand it. I hate to say that, but I go back to Minnesota and I have a very difficult time because I have run into my old friends and they say, well, what's your per confirmed member giving now? And how many new members have you got? Gosh, yes, I can hardly stand it. I get so stultified. And I don't know, is there that much competition back there that the parishes, the councils are telling them you've got to produce along these lines? Or I don't feel it quite as much out here, but we got other problems out here.
I see it somewhat related to, or very much related to, what we're talking about this morning in meeting, when you're talking about longevity, strength, and increase, you're meeting the needs of the pastor. I mean, and he's, you know, he's not meeting people's needs. And I don't say that, I say that in the sense that pastors are human and they get caught up in the same humanness as all the rest of us, and that they need this pat on the back that says, yeah, I've got a really big church, that makes me okay. And it's hard for them, it's hard for any of us to be vulnerable like that. And I agree that that's what, any time that we can come and be vulnerable and honest and truthful, then we are at the plane where we're going to touch ourselves and other people. So I just see it as kind of a, what we were talking about this morning in I can't remember his name.
Jim Lundy.
Yeah, in that class.
Maybe it would help in Australia, like we were in Australia, to give you a general president and your first year graduate the same pay. Does away with a lot of that competition.
Mm-hmm.
It frees you up to go where you feel you deserve this.
No, I think that's an excellent kind of idea. And I know that at least within the Lutheran Church in Canada, that notion has been suggested and has faced violent opposition by some pastors.
I'm not sure I entirely heard what you said.
That the general president of our church in Australia and first year graduate and everybody in between gets equal pay.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Same basis.
Yeah, William Hume tried to push that to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although they're cheating us, right?
That's important.
Just as an aside, the bell has rung, so I mean, please feel free to leave or whatever, but if you want to stay and talk about this a little more, I'm willing to do that, and you know, anytime, please feel free to come up to me. You'll probably see me walking around with a coffee cup in my hand, and I'm always glad to talk with you over a cup of coffee. And it's free here, so you don't even have to buy it for me. So what if you know? But again, you know, thank you for your patience in that. But what I will be doing in the next week is in other sessions in terms of trying here to chart the problem. Now, as you have said, you know, is there some alternatives? And I think yes, and I want to talk about the next session, koinonia, in terms of hospitality, and then sense of participation, and the last one is relating this sense of koinonia and community to the theology of the cross. And so those are my three constructive proposals and suggestions.
We're going to get a good session on entertainment and evangelism then.
Entertainment evangelism, yes. Dan Erlander will play his.
Good.
No heart.
Give people.